May it please the Court. I'm Jonathan Sternberg, and I represent the appellant Jean Olufsen. Ms. Olufsen brought a Rule 7406B2 action to set aside the property division in her dissolution decree due to her ex-husband Tom's fraud in hiding a pending sale of his company, which affected that division. The trial court entered a judgment on the pleadings dismissing her Rule 7406B action solely because it held it was moot or abated as early on during that action Tom died. This was error. This court should reverse the trial court's judgment and remand this case for further proceedings. Denying my client her day in court and any relief from Tom's fraud simply because he died departs from the uniform law of Missouri for more than 90 years and everywhere else I can find in America, too, without exception. As this court, in the Hemphill case in 1962, and every other court in America to have decided this issue has held, my client's post-judgment action to set aside the division of property due to her ex-husband's fraud in the dissolution does and must survive that fraud.
Well, the other states that you're relying upon, do they have a similar rule as we do with 7406B?
Yes, Your Honor. Some of them do. Some of the more recent cases especially do. We rely on a series of cases on pages 55 to 58 of our brief, our opening brief. The ones I would point the court to especially are the Palco case from the New Jersey Supreme Court in 1977, which construes an identical rule to Rule 7406B2. Rule 7406B2, of course, is based on the older version of Federal Rule 60B. This court took it directly from that, as the court noted before. We also rely on a Washington case from the Washington Supreme Court in 1998, which also has an identical rule to Rule 7406B2. So yes, Your Honor, that's correct. And this isn't a question of old cases or other cases from other states. It's also grounded in the modern law of Missouri. In the Linzeni case in 1997, this court restated an existing bright line test for when a spouse's death moots an action related to a dissolution of marriage. The bright line test is this: if the death comes before the marriage is dissolved, the action abates and must be dismissed because the marriage has been dissolved by that death. And if the death comes after the decree is issued, it doesn't cause a pending action at any stage on the issue of distribution of property to abate. And the reason for this, as Missouri courts and courts throughout the country, we cite a...
But hadn't the property already been distributed in this case? I mean, we're talking about setting aside a judgment. That case, I don't think, really dealt with setting aside a judgment of the same facts, did it?
No, Linzeni did not. But what Linzeni held was there's a bright line test. What I was going to get to, Your Honor, is since Linzeni, the courts of Missouri, and this is in our opening brief as well, we have a series of similar cases. It's on pages 32 and 33 of our brief. Every case that has followed Linzeni has upheld this bright line test. So some, for example, Your Honor just said some of the property has already been distributed. In some of these cases, such as the Cregan case in 1983, which Linzeni followed, it was an appeal after the dissolution. And while the case was on appeal, the respondent died. And the respondent's estate was substituted in the Court of Appeals for the respondent. And nonetheless, this is the Western District sitting on bank, reversed and remanded for a redivision and redistribution of the estate. And that was about 16 months after the party had died. So clearly, it applies, it's a bright line test that applies regardless of the procedural posture the case is in. And applying that test here, Tom's death after the party's dissolution decree did not abate my client's Rule 7406B2 action, which sought to set aside the decree's property division due to fraud.
Has the doctrine of abatement ever been applied in an independent action for fraud in Missouri?
This court has Missouri courts have addressed it three times. In the Anderson case in 1970, in the Hemphill case from this court in 1962, and the Richmond case from the Court of Appeals in 1920, which the other two all relied on. All of those held, now this is before Rule 7406B2, but all of those held that an independent post-judgment action to set aside a dissolution property division for one party's fraud survives the tortfeasor's death, and largely, as the court explained in Richmond in 1920, for the same reasons as the Linzeni case, that Once the dissolution itself has been entered, there's no longer a personal action. It's a property action that devolves on the parties. And in Richmond, the court has even said, analyzing cases from other states, that it's unnecessary at that point to set aside the dissolution of marriage itself, because one party is dead and that the effect of that has been accomplished. But instead, if there's been fraud as to the distribution of party, it can be set aside for that reason. Anderson is even more instructive. In Anderson, the Court of Appeals actually reversed a holding that a similar action was moot because a party had died. And at that point, by the time the Court of Appeals had reversed it, it was several years after. And that's Anderson in 1970. Now, all of these cases, I concede, predate Rule 7406b2. But as we explain in our opening brief, the law of Missouri has never made a distinction between the independent action that existed at common law and the action that it incorporated into this court incorporated in Rule 7406b2 in 1988. In fact, in a series of cases that we cite in our opening brief, I list them out in bullet point, cases involving a request to set aside a dissolution of marriage or a property division in it for fraud consistently, after Rule 7406b2, incorporate and use all the prior cases. So, for example, we rely on the Hewlett case from 1993 and the Essig case from 1996 from the Court of Appeals, both of which were under Rule 7406b2. And in Essig, the court specifically only set aside just the division of the marital estate itself, and the Court of Appeals affirmed. That relied on Hewlett, which in turn relied on Alexander from 1980 before Rule 7406b2, where the Court of Appeals affirmed doing the same thing. And this is because, as you know, this court made clear in the years since promulgating Rule 7406b2, all it was intended to do is codify that prior common law action.
Can I ask the Spicuzzo case from the Eastern District, how do you deal with that case?
The Spicuzzo case says that you can't, that Rule 7406 makes no provision for relief from part of a judgment. I'll note that in Spicuzzo, it cites no authority for that statement at all. And all the cases that relied on that statement, the Settles case in 1995, O'Manus in 2000, Young in 2008, all of them simply take that as gospel, even though the court in Spicuzzo never actually said why Rule 7406 makes no provision. And the court was wrong. As we explain in our brief, I think that's dicta. The court in Spicuzzo was really just saying you can't have an action to modify a prior decree under Rule 7406. You can set it aside, but you can't modify it. But then it added on, also you can't have relief from part of a judgment. So I think that's dicta. But if it's not dicta, I'd ask the court to overrule that statement, because Rule 7406 clearly does allow relief from part of a judgment, as every other jurisdiction that I can find, and we elucidate this in our opening brief, has held. On motion and upon such terms as are just, the court may relieve a party or his legal representative from a final judgment. On such terms as are just. And universally, other states encountering this situation, and the federal courts, remember, of course, again, that this court adopted Rule 7406B in 1988 from what then was the text of Federal Rule 60B. And the federal courts, we have a series of cases that I list on and discuss on page 49 of our opening brief, explain that this allows relief from part of a judgment if those are the terms that are just. And, of course, that's a matter of the trial court's discretion. And I'll also note, Your Honors, that my opponent concedes this. My opponent on page 34 and 35 of their brief concede that under 7406B, there can be relief from just the property division. And I think it's, to their credit, they have to concede that because that's what the court did in the Essig case and was affirmed.
So what you're asking us to do today is to overrule all three courts of appeals. Is that right?
No, Your Honor. I'm asking you to accept the Court of Appeals in Anderson and Richmond, upheld this court's own case in Hemp Hill in 1962, and overrule that one statement from the Spicuzzo case. The other cases there are no decisions. The Spicuzzo and the three decisions that rely on it aren't like this case at all. And not a single one of them was a party asking to set aside a division of marital property for fraud. And in fact, in the Young case, distinguishing a request to modify a prior judgment from what we're asking for here, the court in Young said all that the party can actually do is obtain a setting aside of the division of marital property. Here, we've actually brought that action, just like in Anderson, Hemp Hill, and Richmond.
But if the court grants the relief you seek and you go back and you convince the trial court to set aside the judgment, what happens next?
Sure. As in Essig and Hewlett, what happens next is since the division of marital property would have been set aside,
the judgment will be set aside.
Only the division of marital property has to be set aside. The entire judgment itself, that is it wouldn't make my client undivorced from her ex-husband. That's the distinction, Your Honor. But what would happen next is, as in any other dissolution of marriage, there would be under 452.301.
Well, in any other dissolution of marriage, if one of the parties dies, the action abates. Why is it that true here?
That's not actually true, Your Honor. It only abates if the marriage itself hadn't been dissolved beforehand. For example, there are a series of cases that we cite where a marriage was dissolved. The Fisher case, which Lanzini relies on. This court in Lanzini relies on Fisher. In Fisher, there was a statement, an order from the trial court, an interlocutory order, that said the marriage is dissolved. Right. Thereafter,
statute allows for that. The statute doesn't otherwise allow for a piecemeal judgment in a dissolution action.
It does. It's a severable part of the judgment. My client doesn't have to be undivorced from her ex-husband. The marriage doesn't have to be undissolved. As in the Richmond case itself, all that has to happen is the division of marital property has to be undone, and then there would be a valuation and a redivision of the marital estate, just as in any divorce action.
And your argument is only the property division was impacted by the fraud.
That's correct, Your Honor. The fraud itself had nothing to do.
If the fraud is proven, if we accept your position.
That's correct, Your Honor. I see I'm out of time. Thank you.
You'll have time on rebuttal.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Bill Odell of the law firm McDowell Rice, Smith & Buchanan, and I'm here on behalf of the respondent, Scott Olufsen, as on behalf of the estate of Tom Olufsen. It is almost as if reading the appellate's brief that there was litigated a different case below than was brought. Originally, the appellant brought a Rule 7406B motion alleging fraud to set aside, and throughout the motion it says, without specifying the decree of dissolution or in the alternative, to set aside some portion so as to effectuate somehow compensation for the alleged shortfall in the payment she received, price per share paid for the Epic stock as part of the party's settlement agreement in the divorce. So to begin with, she never asked for the relief that the appellant now says she asked for. It was either set aside the decree or set aside some portion thereof so as to somehow effectuate a equitable division of the estate through compensating her for the price on her Epic stock.
Was there any other portion of the decree? Was there child support ordered or maintenance ordered?
No, the decree, the division of property included, as we point out in our brief, not just the Epic stock. It was their largest marital asset, but Tom Olufsen assumed 7.5 something, all the marital debt. And that's part of our point under setting aside a judgment. Well, first of all, it is not correct that we ever took the position that the trial court could not set aside a divisible portion, the entire property settlement, and not the underlying divorce. We never said that. We've never taken that position. And in fact, that's not what the trial court ruled. The trial court ruled that if it were to set aside the judgment, and it presumed that it had the authority to set aside just the divisible portion of the property judgment without, quote unquote, undivorcing the parties, the trial court said, okay, well, if I set it aside, what happens then? What effectual relief can the court issue that will remedy the situation? And so at the time that the appellant's Rule 7406B motion was first filed, of course, Mr. Olson was alive. And it made sense that, and in fact, that was a position we took in our opposition to the to that motion. If the underlying decree was set aside, the parties would relitigate the division of marital property, including division of the entire marital estate, as 452.3301 requires it to do. And at that point, you know, they could have reached a different, in fact, my client could have established to the court, or our former client could establish to the court, that that was an inequitable division. Perhaps he should have gotten more than the parties originally agreed to. But that couldn't happen, as the trial court found. Once Mr. Olson died, what, assuming that then you've set aside the property division, you can't just carve out one asset, or that's tantamount to just simply modifying the judgment. You can't reallocate the entire marital estate using all the statutory factors that are enumerated.
Why not? Why can't you reallocate the entire estate using these statutory factors?
Well, because 360 days after the final judgment was entered, unappealed judgment was entered dividing the marital estate.
No, there was my question is, why can't you reallocate the estate?
Well, as the trial court, I think, correctly found, the marital estate by that point in time was no longer extant. So there was no way for Mr. Olson, for example, to litigate and defend against the claim that it was an inequitable division of property because, you know, he had passed away. It wasn't a question of abatement as applied to a Rule 7406 motion. It was mootness. And the question was, what effectual relief can the court enter? And in response to that, once Mr. Olson died, when we moved for judgment on the pleadings, appellant's position in the trial court was that, well, sure, you can get effectual relief. You can get effectual relief through awarding damages. And to the extent to which the appellant now tries to argue that that was just an analogy, if you go back and look at the briefing, their opposition to our motion for judgment on the pleadings at document 32, on page 3, a motion to set aside a judgment pursuant to Rule 7406 as sought by petitioner is illegally and factually distinguishable from a pre-decree divorce case. It is not an action to modify a judgment. It's an action to set it aside on the basis of fraud, thus creating independent legal action for monetary damages, which does not abate upon the death of the petitioner.
In their pleading, did they plead monetary damages as an alternative remedy?
Yes.
And so they did plead that they were entitled to a redetermination of the division of property with, and I assume other places in the case, arguing that your client could have been, Mr. Olofsson could have been his interest represented by his personal representative.
I'm sorry, Judge, I didn't.
A personal representative would step in for him when he died, and so their remedy, their request was for a redivision of the property.
Well, first of all, I think if you go back and look at the Rule 7406B motion, it doesn't say, as I said earlier, she asked for the dissolution decree to be set aside in its entirety.
And what would be the consequences if the court found fraud, which would entitle Mrs. Olofsson to have it set aside, if in fact that has to be the entire decree and you start over, then does the whole action abate? And there is no dissolution, and she would have her rights under that.
To take his elect against the estate as a widow?
Unless there was some provision that hadn't been changed.
Well, I think the remedy in that event would have been to have brought up a straight-up action for fraud rather than try to undo a property division a year after a final unappealed judgment.
Wouldn't you have argued res judicata?
We did argue.
No, I mean, particularly if they brought an independent action for fraud.
Well, it's not... it hasn't, the fraud claim hasn't been litigated in the context of the 7406 motion, so the res judicata wouldn't necessarily apply to an independent action for fraud against the estate. which there was nothing preventing the appellant from bringing.
Maybe I missed it. I thought that it clearly hasn't been litigated, but I thought you argued.
We argued collateral estoppel in the context. Oh, pardon me. I'm sorry. We argued collateral estoppel in the context of the underlying divorce. One issue was whether or not Epic Systems, which was Mr. Olofsson's company that he helped found, was in the midst of exploring opportunities to perhaps go private. There was a strategic committee, management committee, that was tasked with trying to find a potential buyer or merger candidate. And so that was known to the appellant and her then attorney, and they sought a motion to compel to get information about what was happening at Epic. In fact, it was basically insider information she was asking for, and both Epic and Mr. Olofsson said, you know, we can't do that. Legally, we can't share that information. That's the basis for her fraud claim, is that he knew that back in February of 2015, that Epic was going to sell for a higher price.
Does that go to the merits of her fraud claim?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so if in fact this court found there was error in dismissing the motion, the 7406B2 motion, you certainly would have a right to present that information and to defend any claim of fraud. So the court would have a right to consider whether or not her claims are proven or not, based on what the facts were that you're arguing counter arguments. Why isn't that the best course, that there is a right for you to defend that claim with that information?
Well, I think it's not the best course, because that was not the relief that the appellant actually asked the trial court for. Again, the Rule 7406 motion asked that the decree be set aside entirely, or that unspecified portions of it be set aside so as to, quote, effectuate some compensation for her Epic stock. Again, document 32, page 4, petitioner filed a motion to set aside the judgment on February 23rd, 2017, seeking damages as a result of Tom's fraud that caused financial damage to petitioner. She's not seeking to set aside the entire property division to reallocate all the marital debts and all the marital assets. In fact, the trial court found that's why the case is moot, because you couldn't do that a year after the final judgment had been entered. It was not appealed, and Mr. Olofsson had died. So that's the question before the trial court was mootness, which is something you don't see even discussed in the appellate's brief. The thing that is also conspicuously absent is what relief could the court have entered how could the court have redivided the entire marital estate using 452.33.3301, using those statutory factors? And the trial court found that it couldn't. And a careful review of the record shows that the appellants never disputed that point. They go on to say, well, the court could have ordered some sort of equalization payment. And all those, I guess it's Shutter v. Siebel. Well, those are divorce actions. And in fact, that's the sort of logical flaw in their whole abatement argument, because all the cases they cite, beginning with Lenzini, are all divorce cases, either, in the bosom of the trial court or on appeal. None of them are Rule 7406 cases. So, it made sense when a party, or when the case law says parties are entitled to have unresolved issues of division of marital property resolved in the same proceeding. That means in the same proceeding. It means in the dissolution case, not a collateral attack on the judgment a year later brought under Rule 7406.
Mr. Odell, what's the difference in this case between mootness and abatement as applies to this case?
I would say that abatement is a subspecies of mootness that applies specifically in divorce cases. Mootness is just the principle of justiciability, of what effectual relief can the trial court or could the trial court grant. We argued that there was none, that the court could not reallocate the marital estate because it didn't exist. The court agreed. But in response to our argument, appellant below in the trial court argued repeatedly that, yeah, you can award me damages. You can compensate me for the short change on the price of the Epic stock I got. Not that, I should have, you should have assumed more debt or some other aspect of the division of property. So, and again, there was, the trial court never purported to disregard the division, the doctrine of divisible finality, that you can set aside a property portion of a judgment. That wasn't even at issue. The court presumed that it could, and then went on to find that it would have done no good, that it because it couldn't follow the statute. And
so no dissolution of marriage, division of property, could be set aside for fraud.
No, I think. I believe that it could. I just not under these circumstances when, in the course of a Rule 7406 proceeding, one party dies. There are no cases cited by appellant under that have these exact facts.
Why isn't the personal representative able to step into the shoes of Mr. Olofsson and his decedent's estate is the equivalent of the marital estate?
Because I don't believe they are equivalent legally. The marital estate was already divided. Ms. Olofsson already had real estate, property, and so the actual estate of Mr. Olofsson would have included property acquired over the year subsequent to the divorce that was clearly not marital property. His son, as trustee for the estate, was not in a position to relitigate all of those issues after the parties had already been divorced over a year.
But Lanzini said that it could be relitigated without the need for testimony from a deceased spouse. So don't we have authority for that?
Within the same proceeding, within the divorce proceeding, not in a collateral attack, in either in an independent action for fraud or under Rule 7406.
Why shouldn't that rule apply in a fraud proceeding as opposed to in, if one can in the dissolution proceeding, why can one not in the an action for fraud?
Well, because no case in Missouri that I'm ever aware of ruled that in the context of Rule 7406 that you can do that. The older cases cited by respondent, I see I'm almost out of time. The older cases cited by respondent are also pre-Uniform Act, which included as part of the Uniform Act, which I think that was adopted in 1974. That's where the division of marital property requirements were imposed. Before that, courts really had very little discretion to divide marital property among the divorcing spouses. And so at that point, if you look at like Hemphill, Anderson, and Richmond, the cases that Mr. Sternberg relies on, those are all cases where the spouse seeking to set aside the dissolution decree sought to set aside the decree in its entirety and elect as a widow to get widow's benefits. So those courts didn't face the same mootness issue that the court below did, trying to fashion some sort of remedy following the statute which governs the division of marital property. I see I'm out of time. If there are other questions, happy to answer them.
Thank you, counsel.
Your Honors, this notion that it's impossible to redivide the marital estate after someone has died is wrong. If you turn,
How does it do that if it isn't there? your client received several million dollars worth of real estate. I don't know if it's still there. Other assets have been dissipated, exchanged, traded, fair market value, not whatever. I mean, how could a trial court even? If it picked a new divorce date, if it picked a new division of the property date, why wouldn't it at least be required to divide the property that was there on that day?
Well, it would be when the dissolution of marriage itself happened, which was several years ago.
How does it really divide property that isn't there?
It has
what if both parties had went and spent $500,000 each. How does it redivide that property that's not
there? Your Honor, trial courts throughout Missouri deal with that exact circumstance all the time. We cite a case that I was involved in a couple of years ago in the Western District called Shutter versus Siebold, where my client had been found to have secreted millions of dollars of marital assets away throughout a long period of time and tried to hide them from the parties, and many of them didn't exist anymore. But the trial court, just as trial courts do throughout Missouri all the time, was able to determine what all the property was worth, how it should be divided, and then make an accounting. You see often in these judgments charts where the trial judge ultimately orders one party to pay the other money. Mr. Odell said maybe my client would owe his client money. That's entirely possible. There are cases where this exact thing has happened, where a party was dead and the estate nonetheless was valued and divided. We cite them on pages 19 of our reply brief. The McIntosh case in the Court of Appeals in 2004, the estate was valued and divided a year after the wife's death and her personal representative was substituted for her. The Cregan case, it was more than 16 months after the husband's death, reversing a trial court and sending it back. And in Anderson in 1980,
in your motion, what exactly is the fraud that you allege?
The fraud we allege is in Mr. Olufsen made numerous knowingly false representations relating to the sale of his company.
Well, enumerate them.
Sure. Yeah. At a deposition, he was asked.
Well, that came before the offer, as I understand it.
The
deposition came before the offer?
There's a chart on page 15 of document 5 of our 7406B motion, which explains that. They were in the middle of receiving those offers at the time of that. But he was asked, have there been any offers to sell the company? And he said, no, there haven't been any compelling offers. And he said that I expect to remain here for a long time to come. And then in the separation agreement itself, which was after they've already rejected an offer of $15 per share as undervaluing Epic, he said, I have nothing further to disclose. Then there was
What should he have disclosed there?
He should have disclosed that as his in his deposition that there had actually been offers to sell the company for over $13.50 a share.
The question he was answering after the offer was received had to do with his assets and liabilities. The question that he answered before the offer came in the deposition was, have you had any offers?
One of the party's largest asset is this millions and millions of shares of stock. And he says, you know, $13.50 is an appropriate valuation, even though he and his committee that he was on already by that point had rejected an offer of $15 as undervaluing Epic. These are things that my client demanded. It's things that my client, at least taking her facts as true in her motion, which this court has to, had argued in her motion. And I see I'm out of time, but I would like to add, if the court will permit me, we never requested an award of monetary damages. If you look at the prayer for relief and the opening paragraph of our 7406B motion, we clearly ask for the judgment to be set aside, and this court has to liberally construe that in my client's favor. The court should not allow Missouri to become an outlier on this issue. It should follow the existing law of Missouri and reverse the trial court's judgment and remand this case for further proceedings.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Your Honors.